Katra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are tackling, well, a historical heavyweight, the Tudor dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking that century between 1485 and 1603,
mm-hmm.
A time with five of the most, well, iconic monarchs in history. We all know the costume dramas, the
three
standard
spearheadings, yeah.
Exactly. But we want to go beyond that, beyond the myths.
That's absolutely right. Because if you think the Tudors were just, you know, destined for some glorious golden age, you might need to rethink that.
Okay.
Our mission today, and we're using the historian John Guy's work as our guide here, is to look at what really drove change. And Guy's central idea is that Tudor rule was actually a precarious and often desperate struggle for survival.
Wow, okay. But wait a minute. If they were always struggling, just fighting to survive, why do we remember them as this incredibly successful, you know, iconic dynasty? Was their propaganda just that good?
Well, the propaganda was certainly brilliant, no doubt. But that's sort of the point Guy makes. What really matters for you listening now is understanding that these huge political shifts, these institutional changes, like the very foundation of the modern English state, they often come not from some grand inevitable plan,
right,
but from personal crisis, from pure luck sometimes, and just ruthless day-to-day pragmatism, making it up as they went along, in a way.
Okay, that definitely sounds like it challenges the standard textbook version.
Yeah.
Let's get into the source then. We're relying on John Guy's interpretation today. Who is this historian looking at the Tudors with such a maybe cynical eye?
Well, John Guy is really one of the absolute top historians of the Tudor period. He's an emeritus fellow at Cambridge. And his authority, it's immense, mainly because he doesn't just rehash old stories.
Mm-hmm.
He goes deep into original archival research. We're talking state papers, private letters, actual government minutes, the kind of stuff they didn't necessarily want everyone seeing at the time.
The behind-the-scenes stuff. He focuses on what he calls high politics. What does that mean exactly?
It basically means stripping away the public image, the propaganda, and focusing instead on the secret negotiations, the power struggles happening inside the Privy Council, you know, within the king's or queen's closest circle.
I see.
Guy tries to show history from the inside out. He reveals the Tudors as these really complex, calculating, sometimes flawed human beings making life or death decisions in real time, not just, you know, marble statues marching towards some preordained destiny.
So, okay, if they weren't destined for greatness, what was their secret? How did they manage to hang on for 118 years through all that crisis?
Well, the core argument is kind of twofold. First, yes, absolutely ruthless pragmatism. They did what they had to do. But maybe their greatest, certainly their most lasting achievement was institutional.
How so?
They systematically shifted England away from being this fractured medieval kingdom run largely by the royal household on a whim,
right,
into a much more powerful centralized state with proper bureaucracy.
And Guy connects this directly back to their shaky start, right? They grabbed the crown through violence and guile at Bosworth Field.
Mm-hmm.
Their actual claim was pretty weak.
Exactly. That fundamental weakness, that illegitimacy, it forced them into this constant battle to secure the succession, to get a viable heir. And that struggle, ironically, is what forged the new state.
So the constant need to survive actually created something new and stronger.
That's absolutely key. The constant, you know, existential crisis of dynastic survival, especially the desperate need for a male heir later on, that's the fire that forged the nation, as Guy sees it. England came out of this century more centralized, more confident, not because of some grand vision, but because its rulers were just constantly reacting to crises to stay afloat.
That sense of urgency makes it feel much more real, much more immediate. So where do we start? I guess with the man who kicked it all off, Henry VII, the usurper?
Henry Tudor, yeah. He won, as Guy puts it, a risky gamble at Bosworth. But his whole reign was just plagued by plots, by pretenders. He was never really secure.
Yet he managed to survive, even thrive. Guy paints him not as that, you know, dull, penny-pinching accountant figure we sometimes get.
No, not at all.
But as this secretive, watchful, kind of ruthless Winter King. Always vigilant.
Operating behind closed doors, yeah. His real skill was political consolidation. He systematically chipped away at the power of those great nobles who could challenge him.
How did he do that?
Well, he built his authority by relying on this small, loyal group of lawyers and administrators, sort of bypassing the traditional, often factious court politics. And crucially, he built up the crown's finances. Very unpopular methods, but highly effective, like the notorious Council Learned in the Law.
Yes, the Council Learned. That was basically his Highly effective, but really feared tax enforcement agency, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Its job was to dig up and enforce the king's old financial rights, slap bonds on wealthy subjects, basically financial handcuffs to ensure their loyalty. Henry VII left his son, Henry VIII, a full treasury, and really for the first time in decades, a secure throne. But it was a security built on fear and tight control, not necessarily love.
Okay, so enter the son, Henry VIII, and this is where it gets, well, really dramatic. He almost immediately puts that stability at risk and turns his personal life into the defining national crisis of the century. The king's great matter, the divorce, the annulment, that's the pivot point.
And Guy is absolutely adamant on this. The break with the Church of Rome, it wasn't primarily about theology, not at first anyway. It was a political revolution driven almost entirely by Henry's dynastic desperation for a male heir.
It's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it? One king's personal problem leads to this massive religious and political earthquake across Europe.
It really is. And the incredible thing is that the administrative genius behind it all wasn't even the king himself, but one of his ministers. How did Thomas Cromwell manage something so huge without, say, a massive army?
Yeah, how?
Cromwell was the ultimate administrator. He engineered the whole break with Rome not through brute force, but by using Parliament in a completely unprecedented way.
The legal route.
Exactly. He drafted the legislation, things like the Act of Supremacy that legally declared Henry the supreme head of the church in England. This wasn't just about religion. Cromwell fundamentally shifted power away from the old medieval household style of government towards a more modern, professionalized state machine. It set this huge precedent. Religious policy could serve political strategy.
But then Cromwell himself fell from power, didn't he? And Henry VIII became, well, even more paranoid later on, leaving behind this chaotic mess of his succession with his three children. Which brings us to what historians call the mid-Tudor crisis, the short, really volatile reigns of Edward VI and Mary III.
Yeah, a real stress test for those institutions Cromwell had helped build. Edward VI's brief reign, that's when you see the really hardcore Protestant reforms taking hold, driven by religious zealots pushing the new Book of Common Prayer onto everyone.
But then Edward died young, and suddenly that threat of dynastic collapse was very real again. There was that coup attempt, but interestingly, Mary VI's claim, her accession, was initially met with quite widespread popular support. People rallied to the legitimate Tudor bloodline.
They did, initially. But her rigid commitment to Catholicism, her ideology, kind of undid her. Marrying Philip II of Spain, that stirred up huge nationalist anti-foreign sentiment.
Right. The Spanish marriage was deeply unpopular.
Deeply. And then the Marian persecutions, burning over 280 Protestants at the stake, it backfired spectacularly. It didn't crush Protestantism. It created martyrs. It actually helped forge this powerful, lasting anti-Catholic English identity.
It's amazing, though, that despite all that religious turmoil, the swings back and forth, the bureaucratic machinery, you know, the Privy Council, the financial offices that Henry VII and Cromwell had built, they survived. That shows real institutional resilience, doesn't it?
It really does. And they needed to be resilient because Elizabeth III inherited the wreckage of those 15 chaotic years. A nation basically bankrupt and torn apart by religious division. Guy portrays her as the ultimate political survivor, a master of pragmatism.
She absolutely needed stability above all else. Her famous Elizabethan religious settlement, It was purely political, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Guy calls it a middle way, basically designed to just calm things down, minimize conflict.
Absolutely. But her entire reign was still overshadowed by the succession problem, and specifically by the threat posed by Mary, Queen of Scots. Guy doesn't see Elizabeth's decision to execute Mary as, like, personal revenge.
No.
He sees it more as a reluctant, almost forced act of state preservation, necessary because of the constant Catholic plot swirling around Mary.
But her real genius, Guy argues, wasn't actually in making big, decisive moves, which she often avoided.
Precisely. Her strength, her unique skill, was her strategic use of ambiguity, calculated indecision. By refusing to marry, refusing to name a successor, not committing too firmly to any one religious or political faction.
She kept everyone guessing.
Exactly. She kept potential foreign husbands dangling, kept domestic rivals perpetually off balance. She mastered the art of political survival by being flexible, elusive, playing the long game.
Okay, so let's zoom out a bit. We've covered this intense 118-year period full of near-misses, crises, improvisation. According to Guy, what are the sort of core, repeated lessons that really defined the Tudor century? Maybe three key themes.
Yeah, I think we can boil it down to three big ones. First, and maybe most importantly, the fragility of legitimacy. This constant gnawing fear of dynastic extinction, it drove almost every major decision. They were always having to prove they deserved the crown they'd basically stolen at Bosworth.
That makes sense. What's the second name?
The second is just how dramatically the personal is political. I mean, the actual physical health, the fertility, even just the whims of the monarch. These weren't private matters. They were issues of national security, driving policy.
Like Henry VIII wanting a divorce, literally changing the country's religion.
Exactly. Or Mariae choosing a husband and alienating almost everyone. The ruler's body and desires were the state in a very real way.
Okay, fragility of legitimacy, the personal is political. And the third.
And finally, perhaps their most enduring legacy, the birth of the modern state. Guy really emphasizes how ministers, particularly Cromwell under Henry VIII and later William Cecil under Elizabeth, transformed government, moved it away from being this sort of extended medieval household operation
Right.
into a professional, centralized bureaucratic machine centered on things like the Privy Council. This administrative revolution is arguably why the English state managed to survive the personal chaos of its rulers.
It's really fascinating how Guy can take all that complex history and distill it into these powerful, memorable statements. Let's maybe look at a couple of his core insights, the quotes that really stick with you.
Yeah, definitely. One of my favorites kind of sums up the whole dynasty's vibe. The Tudor monarchy was less an institution of established strength and more a continuous act of political improvisation driven by the ever-present fear of extinction.
That really captures the feeling of them just reacting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Constantly putting out fires, survival being the main goal, not some grand plan.
Exactly. And then there's the one about Henry VIII's big move, which is just essential. The English Reformation began not as a popular spiritual movement, but as a desperate and radical solution to a king's dynastic crisis.
And that aha moment, isn't it? Connecting Henry's personal biological anxiety directly to this massive religious and political upheaval.
It cuts right through the usual narratives. And one more on Elizabeth. Elizabeth's genius lay not in decisive action, but in her mastery of ambiguity and the art of political survival.
Yeah, that challenges that whole Gloriana decisive warrior queen myth. It paints her as much more of a pragmatic, strategic operator, which feels, well, more realistic, maybe.
I think so. Highlights her shrewdness.
So bringing this all back to today, what does this Tudor drama mean for you listening now? These are centuries-old political struggles, but Guy's analysis seems to offer some pretty timeless lessons, especially about leadership and maybe organizational change.
Oh, absolutely. Look at the leadership styles. Guy contrasts Henry VII, the cautious consolidator, the one who builds those solid, maybe unpopular financial controls.
The long-term planner, in a way.
Versus Henry VIII, the autocratic risk taker, betting the farm on his personal desires. If you're running a business or any organization, do you want a leader like Mary the Guy's who rigidly sticks to a plan even when it's failing because of conviction? Or maybe more like Elizabeth, who uses strategic delay ambiguity to wait for better conditions or keep options open. Success often hinges on adapting flexibly to reality.
That makes sense. And what about organizational change? It sounds like the Tudor Revolution wasn't one big dramatic event.
Not at all. Guy shows it was this gradual accumulation of precedents. It was messy, iterative, often driven by bureaucrats like Cromwell, quietly changing systems. It wasn't a single, clean, revolutionary break.
So the lesson is, if you want lasting change in an organization, you probably have to chip away at it systematically. Break down those old power structures, those overmighty nobles or entrenched silos, kind of like Henry II did.
Exactly. It's often slow, unglamorous work, not a flashy announcement. And of course, there's the whole angle of strategic communication, of narrative. The Tudors were absolute masters of propaganda.
The Tudor rose, the Virgin Queen image.
Precisely. They understood instinctively that power isn't just held, it has to be constantly performed. You have to control the story, shape the perception, especially when your underlying legitimacy might be, well, a bit fragile.
Thinking back on Guy's perspective, what surprised me most, actually, was how crucial Henry VI seems. He's often seen as the less glamorous one, sandwiched between the Wars of the Roses and Henry VIII. But Guy really emphasizes that he laid the groundwork. He built the bureaucracy, the financial controls that arguably allowed the whole dynasty to weather the storms his more famous children and grandchildren created.
That's a great point. He built the ship in a way. For me, what really stands out is Guy's powerful reminder that history is just so contingent, it could easily have gone another way.
Right.
The survival of the Tudors wasn't inevitable. It was, as Wellington said of Waterloo, a near-run thing. They kind of accidentally forged a new kind of nation while they were fundamentally just trying to ensure their own family stayed on the throne.
Which leads us perfectly into a final provocative thought for you to mull over. The Tudors' success depended so much on projecting strength and legitimacy while constantly masking their underlying fragility. So think about a major institution or organization you interact with today. Maybe it's a government department, a big corporation, even a university. What might be the hidden flaw, the vulnerability in its succession plan or its core legitimacy that's being papered over right now, just waiting for the next big crisis to expose it? See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.